This guy didn't have a deep, dark time. This guy had a fun time playing for the Braves, was on that World Championship team in 95, as we continue to celebrate.
Missing Braves baseball? Yeah, us too. So Nick and Chris are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Braves' 1995 World Series title as they're joined each week by a member of the 95 team.
Mark gets the sign. The wind and the pitch. Here it is. Swung. Fly ball deep left center. Grissom on the run. Yes! The Atlanta Braves have given you a championship.
Only here on the home of the Braves, The Fan.
Mark Lemke joins us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. Lemmer, what's going on?
Hey, Nick, Chris, doing great. Love the show. Finally feel like this is like the first day I was called up. You know, I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller. I feel like I've made it to the show.
That's crazy. You've never been on the show?
I don't believe so.
I think you're right.
I did not realize that until you just brought it up. Well, welcome aboard.
So I feel like I'm a minor leaguer, and the manager says, come to my office.
Yeah.
He said, kid, you're going to the show.
Yeah, that's one heck of an analogy.
And at 11:20, Matt Edgar is going to call you, and you are a part of this. Hey, I've never asked you all the years we've known each other and worked together, how much of those games have you actually watched? It's crazy because I have people tell me, you know, when Rizzuto was calling games, if you're a player on the field, you don't really hear a lot of that stuff. How much of these games have you actually watched over the years?
Meaning the postseason games?
Yeah, postseason games.
I think right afterwards you'd go back and maybe watch it a little bit, and then a few years down the road. I know recently they had some of the postseason games for the Braves on MLB Network. And I started to turn them on, and I said, oh, do I want to do this again? I mean, it's been 25 years, but it was great to look back. I think the thing that's disappointing is you look back and you say, boy, we look young.
When you win the title, when Marquise Grissom catches that ball, is it relief? Is it joy? Is it all of the above that washes over you?
All of the above. I think if you guys remember back in 91, 92, we went to the World Series and we lost. And it was right during that time, I mean, the Buffalo Bills had went to four Super Bowls. And you start hearing people mumble. Now, I don't remember how much was in the media, or was it just like guys and that you'd see out would say, hey, you guys are going to turn into the Buffalo Braves or something here. And you felt that sense of urgency, and it was just such a relief to finally win a championship the third time around. And if you don't win that year, boy, I tell you, there was a lot of pressure on the guys. And it's not like you can control it. You know, it's not like you can say, hey, this one I think we ought to let's go ahead and win this one. And it's not how it works. And then when you look across the field, out of all the teams that scared me, it was the Cleveland Indians. When you looked at that lineup, you say, how are we going to stop this lineup? But we had that great pitching. They had the great hitting. It was a classic. Good pitching beats good hitting. And we did it. And Tom Glavine sealed the deal.
Hey, Len, it's 9 times out of 10, the good pitching is going to beat the good hitting. But I understand the apprehension going in. You look at a team like, I don't know, the 88 Dodgers. They had no business beating the A's, but it happened. Not to say you guys had no business doing it, but when you got the horses on the mound, you got to think you have an advantage there.
Well, the old adage is great pitching, good defense, and timely hitting. And the Dodgers, obviously, if you look at that 88 series, they had the timely hitting. And I think back to the Twins and the Blue Jays, the Yankees, obviously, in 96. Everybody's going to have a good team. They're there for a reason. And when you think about the 95 season, it was interesting because it was in limbo. You know, we had that strike in 94. The real good team that year probably was the Montreal Expos. But the divisions were so close at that time. When I think when we went on strike, the biggest lead might have been, you know, the Yankees 6.5 over Baltimore, but that strike had to have been devastating to a lot of teams, and one of those teams was Montreal. But that strike became our benefit because with that strike, Montreal had to dismantle their team, which allowed us to pick up the guy who cost the final out, Marquise Grissom, a huge part of that 95 club.
Yeah, we'll talk about him in a second. I do want to ask, because the games were on around the country. Everybody knows that through TBS, and I'm not sure how much your buddies up in upstate New York were able to watch it. But when 91 doesn't go your way, when 92 doesn't go your way, you go home maybe during the off season, you get phone calls, you talk to you. How the hell do your buddies treat you at that point before you win, knowing how close it was, knowing how great a series you actually had in one of those World Series? What's the relationship between your buddies at that point, and what's the conversation like?
Well, it was excitement for those guys. I mean, my buddies were great. And, they would talk different ways back there in upstate New York. They're like, I can't tell you how much money you guys won me. I'm like, wait, hey, I don't want to know about that. But, no, it was a great time. And as a player, you're thinking, wow, we just went to the World Series in 91. We went from worst to first. And I'll never forget, during that series, talking to Jim Cott. And he was a guy, I think he still holds a record for appearances between World Series. And he told me, he says, you know, he goes, enjoy this. He says, because you'll never know when you'll get back to another World Series. Now, we went to five in the decade of the 90s, but you don't know that in 91. He said to me, I went to my first World Series. Well, I forget, he was 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. He goes, I didn't get back to my next World Series until I was 42 years old. So that sunk in. You started to think, hey, just because things went well in 91 doesn't mean it's going to keep going well the next decade. But it obviously did. But I never forgot that when Jim Cott said that to me.
Mark Lemke with us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. Your postseason numbers speak for themselves. Can you pinpoint the how and the why? Can you put into words why you were able to perform the way you did in the postseason?
No explanation other than maybe they overlooked you. You know, maybe they concentrated on other guys in the lineup. I mean, there was obviously some big sluggers in our lineup as well. But the other thing, too, was, you know, you just had to remember you're just playing another game. You got to relax. And if you get a pitch, you got to let it go. You can't hold back on anything. And when things happened, you know, you have flashbacks to your childhood. You start saying, wow, these were the days when you were in your backyard and you were pretending you were Reggie Jackson or one of these guys that were World Series heroes. So it was kind of one of those things where you talk about the dream come true. Well, that was it for me.
Can I, as a kid, I in terms of who you rooted for, I know that you grew up sort of in a Yankee house, but are you aware, we had Glenn Hubbard on a couple of weeks ago, and I think Blauzer is another one of these guys. It's easy to like or root for the superstars, but I think there's something to fan bases that actually root for the guys that look a little bit more like them. 27th round?
Yeah, 27th round.
So were you aware when you were playing, or are you aware now that, no doubt about it, Hall of Famer over here, Hall of Famer over there, there's Fred McGriff, should be in the Hall of Fame. What your place is with fans because of maybe that every guy mentality and then having big moments when maybe some of the biggest names in the game didn't have some of those moments?
Yeah, when I think back to the stars, now obviously I brought up Reggie Jackson growing up in upstate New York. You know, you're going to remember the big home runs and the World's the three home run game against the Dodgers. But there was Al Weiss. There was the Doyles, Brian Doyle. There was Bucky Dent. There was plenty of those guys that were those heroes. And it seemed like every year there was one of those guys. You know, was it Phil Garner or one of those types? So you always felt like every World Series, there's going to be somebody that somebody doesn't expect that rises up during those times. And fortunately for me, things worked out like that. But when I think about my role on the team, I think you have to look up and down the club and know what your role is. And to me, a lot of times they used to say, we were able to sign you, Greg Maddux, because of my financial status. So you don't have a superstar here, but we put another one somewhere else.
I go back to what you said, pretending you're in your backyard. So it was a tense time. It's an intense moment, but you're still having fun, it sounds like, through the moment, appreciating where you are.
No doubt. A lot of times I would step in the batter's box, take a deep breath, and then say to myself, you know what? You got to take the pressure off of Chipper Jones, Fred McGriff, David Justice. It don't have to be them. It can be you. You know, this guy's not going to want to walk you. He's going to come right after you. Be ready. A lot of times I jumped right out. The first thing I saw that was close and hittable, I'm jumping on it because I know this guy's going to come after me. He's not going to pitch around me. That's the way I felt when I went in the box in those situations. Because the more pressure in those games, it's not one of those games during, you know, let's say June or July where the pitcher walks you, yeah, he can say, well, I made a mistake. How can I walk this guy in front of McGriff or with someone else coming up to the plate, or Chipper Jones in the slot. I got to go right after this guy. I think that was a different story in the postseason. They were going to make sure they weren't going to put me on base, so I think I was going to get better pitches to hit. And that being said, you better be ready to swing the bat.
We mentioned, I asked you, 27th round. Nick, do you know what Baseball America declared one Mark Lemke?
I don't.
Mark, go ahead, tell him.
I was all-time number one 27th round pick.
So he's the best the greatest of all the 27th round picks. You're atop that list.
And, you know, back then there was only about 30-something rounds. But that was it was kind of odd. I just looked back. I mean, there were some pretty good players selected. Believe it or not, I think Don Mattingly was 20th pick, 20th round. Ryan Sandberg was later on.
I think Smoltz is the greatest 22nd round pick. There were two guys in the 20s that were Atlanta Braves mainstays, and you and Smoltz both selected in the 20s.
And, you know, there's something to be said for later rounds. There's not as much competition. Now, you go to the early rounds, there's probably a lot of guys and a lot of competition. I think later on it changed because they started having more rounds. You know, you look at Marcus Giles. I think he was 50-somethingth round. You look at Mike Piazza. What round was
63?
He a 50-something round?
No, he was 60.
62. Yeah, we didn't even have 60 rounds back then. Hey, I think it ended about 30.
I wanted to ask you about Giles. We talked about it the other day. The day that you find out that him and Justice are traded, what's your thoughts?
Say that again? Giles or Grissom?
Yeah, the day that you found out that Grissom, excuse me, and Justice were traded, what were your thoughts?
That was a little bit of a downer. My thoughts were, I mean, because it was right at the end of spring training. And, you know, they were such a big part of the club. David, I come up with. A lot of the guys I come up with and played against Markeith, then played with him and knew what kind of guy he was and how valuable he was to the club. It was a little devastating. I know Kenny Lofton was an electric player, and I admired him. And all that being said, it was hard to see those guys go at that time, I'll be honest with you.
Well, Grissom, we talked about him a little bit, Mark, yesterday. I don't think people realize how important he was throughout the season, but then going to the postseason, he hit the cover off the ball.
Oh, yeah. He was another one. I think he's an underrated postseason player and an underrated player all year long. He got the job done on the field, but he was great in the clubhouse. Everybody loved him. He came to win, and he could play as good a center field as anybody. And, you know, he did things that he needed to do to help the club win. I'll never forget, I asked Marquise. You know, I said, it was really tough trying to play second base and trying to hold you on second when you were in Montreal because, I mean, you guys were running all over the place. And but now you're down here in Atlanta, and I like it better because, you know, you don't cause so much havoc for us infielders. And he said to me, he said, in Montreal, I had to run. That's how we had to score runs. You know, we weren't going to score runs if he didn't steal bases and move along. He says, here in Atlanta, I don't have to run as much. I can pick my spots because we got guys that can knock you in from first base, much less second and third.
We asked Hubbard about this. Second base used to be the wild, wild west. I mean, basically it was, you know, do whatever mm-hmm. the hell you want. Was there a guy or two, did you have your moment where you were knocked into the grass in the outfield, or were you also capable? I'm assuming, knowing you a little bit, you don't want to get down. I'm throwing this thing right between your eyeballs. You better get down.
No doubt. I mean, yeah, I even spoke to Don Baylor about this, and Don was talking about hit by pitch, and he goes, you know what happens when the pitcher hits you, don't you, Lemmer? He goes, you know, don't you? I said, yeah, I know, Don. You're coming after me at second base. I don't know why, but they just want to destroy your second base. But, yeah, I had some guys, you know, a funny story was Chris Sable. Was a guy, I mean, he would come in as hard as could be. Kirk Gibson, I mean, these guys were going to rip you apart. But so one day we're playing Cincinnati, and Maddox threw one up and in on Chris Sable, and I said, oh, shit, Greg, don't get him all riled up, you know what I mean? So Sable's trying to hit this ball into Cleveland from Cincinnati. He hits a dribbler instead of a home run. Down the third baseline. Now he's on first. And I said, he's coming after me. And finally, the hitter hit a one-hop line drive at Blauser, froze Sable. over to me, over to first. We turn a double play. Sid Bream's throwing the throw around back to me, and Sable's still coming. He's still coming. He's going to try to take me. His whole mentality was, I'm taking the second baseman out no matter what.
It's a quest.
I don't care how many outs there are.
Mark Lemke with us.
Man down there.
Yeah, I guess. Mark Lemke with us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line. When you look back on that season, going into the postseason, is there one or two moments that maybe stand out more so than any other for you?
I think, you know, 95 was obviously the capper. I mean, that's what you set out to do, and it meant so much to me. A lot of the guys, we come up together. I always tell a story how in 1983 I was drafted. I went to rookie ball, then got sent back to rookie ball the following year and wasn't feeling too good about it. It's 1984, and a knock on the door comes, and I open the door, and it's Tom Glass. And so I was his first roommate. And, you know, when you get to that point where you come together through the minor leagues and you get to the major leagues and you win a championship, you know, it's hard to – you couldn't fathom that in 1984. And here you are basically 10 years later and you're hugging each other, winning a world championship.
What's the story about you and him in the car? And what kind of music were you listening to? What the hell is this story that I was hearing?
Well, we used to ride the park. A lot of times we'd carpool the park. And, you know, he liked this one song, and I liked it too. And it was kind of a heavy metal kind of song. And neither one of us, I would think, would be like that kind of music guys. But, boy, I think when we got to the ballpark, we both were ready to rumble. How about that? I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation. You know, we start out, how you doing? How was your day? Get out, you know, take a couple of turns, start heading towards the ballpark. He said, all right, turn that song on. And then that would be the end of our conversation.
Yeah. It's like Chris and I before the show. We don't say two words to one another.
We listen to metal. We listen to a lot of German death metal is actually what we listen to.
Gets the blood flowing.
Have you guys, Chris, have you moved in with Nick yet?
No, we've separated. We're actually trying. We got the attorneys. Ray Giudice wrote up a legal separation paper for now.
He had to go, Mark. I couldn't get rid of him.
So, hold on, Nick. You got to ask.
You're getting comfy.
A little bit. You got to ask him the question I told you to ask him.
Oh, I can't remember. What was the question again?
What does he have that signifies the idea that he would have been the World Series MVP? It's an actual tangible thing.
So in 1991, we say it all the time. If the Braves win that World Series, you're the MVP. What do you have?
I have an Indian. A wooden Indian.
How big? How tall?
Oh, the Indian's bigger than me. He's probably about 6 foot, 6 foot one, and it takes about five guys to move this thing.
So what was the significance?
It's solid wood. It weighs about 600 pounds.
Why do you have this? Tell him why you have this.
Well, there was a guy in Arizona, Ben Hyman, and there's a little plaque on it. Before the Braves, when it was announced the Braves were moving to Atlanta in 1965 or whenever, and he said, I'll carve this Indian. I'm going to put it in the Braves front office when the team moves to Atlanta. And this is to be given to the Braves' first MVP, the Braves' MVP of their first World Series. So this thing was sitting in the office for 25 years. And you know, I didn't know about it. Nobody knew about it. I'm surprised people in the front office knew about it. After that series, that offseason, somebody gives me a call and says, hey, there's a big Indian here in the front office that I think it's yours. Do you want it? You know, they were like, do you want it? I said, heck yeah, I want it. Mm-hmm. When they brought this thing over, I couldn't believe the size and the weight of it. Incredible. It's still in my house today. Man, when people come in, the air conditioning guys, everybody stops and says, they just look at it. It's unbelievable.
Can't put a price tag on that, Mark.
No.
I don't think.
Hey, real quick, tell everybody about West Palm. We were talking about the Safari Room and West Palm compared to every place else. Do you know Nick? He played for the Durham Bulls. He was actually there, right? You played for them, and then the West Palm experience for spring training.
Yeah, the Durham year was, after the season ended, the guys that hung around Durham at the time were actually in the movie Bull Durham. I didn't get to be in it, but I watched that movie every once in a while, and I'll see some of Merrill Canyons and stuff. But that was a great year, and Durham was a great place. But you go to that, I doubt if they have the season start in Arizona and quarantining those guys in a hotel. I think a lot of those guys would like to be quarantined in that hotel we stayed in West Palm Beach. I'll tell you that much.
Might not get to the games.
That was dangerous. It's amazing that they even put it up. That might have been the number one nightclub in the whole area. I mean, the surrounding area, because you'd go down there and there'd be three teams in that. It'd be the Expos, the Braves, and the Mets. The Mets would drive down from Port St. Lucie. That's how this place was.
It was incredible. And major leaguers were staying. All you had to do was hit a button on an elevator.
Yeah. You'd come downstairs. I mean, from a safety standpoint, it was great. But you know what the problem was the fans had access, too. So yeah. It was like, you know, you're going down, you're in, you're out. But it was a different time back then. You know, there was no cell phones. There was no picture taken. You could relax. People could mingle with you. They didn't bother you. They might come up and say something to you, but I never remember anything bad happening. And then on the flip side, you say to yourself, if you stayed in your room, you'd hear the music thump, boom, 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 boom. You'd hear this music out there. There's no way you're going to sleep. And curiosity is just like, look, I'm going down there. I'm on my way.
Yeah, let me just go see what's going on. I'll check in and check out. It's innocent.
That's it. Just want to check where this noise is coming from.
Well, Mark, hopefully you're on with the Braves pre- and post-game. Again, hopefully there's baseball in the not-too-distant future. What are your thoughts on possibly playing in Arizona before we let you go?
Well, at least it was positive news. I think there's a ton of things they got to work out before when you really think about it. I mean, it sounds great, but there's a lot of things you're going to have to work out before you get this going. I was just happy to hear some kind of news. How about that?
Yeah, I think we're all in the same boat there. Mark, thanks for coming on. We'll talk some baseball down the road.
All right, thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lemke.
Mark Lemke, first time ever on this program. Did not know that as he joins us on the Loud Security Systems Newsmaker line.
Can you imagine him and Glavin driving down 400 and the windows are up and you just look over and you go, what the hell are they listening to? They listened to metal. It was how Glavin got up the days that he pitched. He'd give Tommy, swear to God, on the days that Tommy pitched, Lemke would give him a ride.
Yeah.
And they started to listen. Like, this
doesn't seem right, but you got to do what you got to do sometimes.